Let's pray. You are our security. You are our rock and our fortress, our eternal home. You are the God who has been before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you formed the earth and the seas. You are God from everlasting to everlasting. We have come into the shadow of your wings. We have entered a holy place of protection and guidance and strength and new life, because you have gathered us around. You have encircled us in yourself and in your Son, whom encamps around the one who fears him. We praise you for doing so. We know that we only have that security in you this evening, and we pray then that in no way would we be running to any other place for it, not even to our own abilities as Christians, not to our performance or the way that we have lived, but only to you, our true God, the one who promises to be with his people. Father, deliver us from self-reliance this evening, and direct us and make us to rest in you yourself, our God, our home, our security. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. I'll turn you please to Nehemiah chapter 4. Nehemiah chapter 4, and we'll read the whole chapter. Mostyn dealt with the first six or so verses last time. We're going to consider the rest of the chapter this evening. We're going to read the whole of it, though. So from Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 1, we will read God's word. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What are they are building? If even a fox climbed up on it, he would break down their wall of stones. Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in the land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders." So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet his threat. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall." Also our enemies said, "Before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them, and we will kill them and put an end to their work." Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." Therefore I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes." When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows and armor. The officers posted themselves behind the people, all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other, and each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. And I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "The work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. At that time I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night, so that they can serve us as guards by night and workmen by day. Neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. Do you ever feel that the Christian life is just one long fight, really? Do you feel that it just sometimes gets completely tiring? Well, if so, hooray! Phew, you are living a Christian life. You're experiencing biblical Christianity. You are resembling Jesus. There's nothing to be afraid about or ashamed of. To be tired, to be feeling under pressure as a Christian, that it's hard work, that it is a fight, that is exactly how the Bible presents the Christian life to us. You are just the same as Jesus. You are just the same as Nehemiah and company. The Nehemiah Construction Corporation was going through the mill, and it had these hard lessons to learn, just like us. Hostility is our normal environment. Readiness is our best protection. Okay, those are the lessons of this chapter I'd like us to learn tonight. Quite simple, really. One, hostility is our normal environment. Two, readiness is our best protection. First, hostility is our normal environment. You remember Jesus said, in this world, you will have trouble. Right? In this world, you'll have trouble. He said that to his disciples, and it's always the case. We have the trouble of the world, of the flesh, and the devil, do we not? And it is best, then, for every believer to realize very early on that their default position in the Christian life is hostility from all sides. If you don't have that awareness, then you are not thinking of the Christian life in a biblical way, and you will soon meet with trouble and disappointment and discouragement unless you realize that the normal Christian life is one of hostility on every side. It's difficult. It's a battle. So here we have in verse 7, hostility on all sides. Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the men of Ashdod. So this is why I've drawn this kind of... You don't know what it is yet, do you? I've got Paris. Do you know what it is? Okay, good. Okay, so here's the Mediterranean Sea, for those of you who don't know what that is. It's got fishing and things. Okay, and then this is Judah here. Or Judea. This is Jerusalem. Let's call that J for the moment. That's the Dead Sea, and that's the Jordan River. Okay, and so you've on the north, you've got Sanballat and the Samaritans. Hopefully I'm spelling that right. He's coming from that direction. And then you've got from the south, the Arabs from Arabia. Okay, and then from the east, you have the Ammonites. This is Ammon here. And now, in addition, this is Ashdod here from the west. So this picture in verse 7 is that from all sides now, north, east, south, and west, you have attack. So in a symbolic way, in a sense, they are oppressed on every side, right? So what's happened then to them is that they have hostility, but it's not because they failed or because they're poor believers, it's because they've persevered, it's because they have stuck at it. Okay, so it's the fruit of their good works, it's the fruit of their trust in God. And so we need to realize that that is what often happens. It's the result of faithfulness. Verse 6, we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, but the people worked with all their hearts. That angers the enemies of God, that angers the devil and his minions. That makes us to be more oppressed. If we are carrying on and we don't know much difficulty, it's because the devil hasn't got much to be worried about. So you need to realize it's the fruit of perseverance rather than unfaithfulness. This hostility stirs up anger and opposition rather than peace. And then we see that there is a united front. It's not just that they're all coming in from separate angles, but in verse 8 we're told that they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble. You see, of course, originally they had fought in a battle of words, right? So they were just saying, oh, you know, they're not very good, and they were mocking them. That's the first five verses or so of their opposition. It's a verbal battle. It's trying to break them down, some mind games, right? But now that's failed. The wall has been rebuilt to half the height, and they are going for actual physical violence. And they're combining, plotting together to create a united front against them, and even to aim at killing them, verse 11, so that the work will come to a stop, right? Now, the way that the people respond to this under Nehemiah is a good way. Verse 9, they prayed to their God and posted a guard day and night to meet his threat. So there is first prayer. That's exemplary in Nehemiah, isn't it? And then action. They must always go together. If you have just prayer without action, that's a kind of presumption, isn't it? And if you have action without prayer, then it's a kind of self-sufficiency, saying that we can do this. But rather, combining the two, prayer and action, it's a good thing. And it's the right response here. And it rebuffs the initial attack from the opposing enemies. However, it does not extinguish the threat. As we continue through the chapter, we'll see that the threat didn't go away. And that is because of our point that hostility is the normal environment for a believer. Okay, so even when we respond rightly, it doesn't mean that the hostility is extinguished. It's our normal environment. I remember reading some of John Owen's, I can't say I've read it all, some of John Owen's famous work on temptation and sin. He has this picture that's always stayed with me, that there's a picture of two men, and they're having a battle. They've got swords and clubs and things, okay? And one of them is fighting, and the other one is not, okay? So what do you think happens in this battle? One of them is getting pummeled. He's just standing there going, ooh, 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 ooh. And the other man is just raining down blows on him. And he's using that as if he says the picture, sin never sleeps, sin never stops attacking us. If we don't fight back, if we don't realize that hostility is our normal environment, that it's always coming to us, of course, what's going to happen? You're going to get beaten up if we refuse to fight back and say, no, I'm not going to be the passive combatant in this hand-to-hand fist fight. No, I need to be just as active as sin against me and to fight and stand up, because hostility is my normal environment. So I'm saying that their initial rebuff doesn't extinguish the threat, but rather it comes now in waves. They must feel it's just piling on top from every angle, not just from their enemies. You'll see in verse 10 then that there's tiredness in the ranks. The people in Judah, from within their own number, say the strength of the laborers is giving out. And there's so much rubble that we can't build the wall. So there's discouragement and tiredness, physical tiredness, I'm sure. And maybe they've been worn down by these oppressors and enemies. And we know about that, don't we? We know about tiredness in the Christian life, spiritual tiredness, physical tiredness in serving God, in the church, in our home life, in our marriages, in our friendships. Tiredness, we know about that. So that's one wave. And then secondly, there's the continued hatred and threats and violence, or threats of violence, from their enemies in verse 11. Before they know it, we'll see us, we'll be right there among them, we'll kill them, we'll put an end to the work. So there's that wave that comes in from the outside. And then thirdly, there's this paranoia from their friends, who perhaps should have known better or could have been more helpful. These scaredy-cat Jews who lived near the enemies, they come and tell us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they'll attack us. Now, some think that that's possibly, you know, they're doing them a favor. They're actually kind of like, you know, double agents or something, and they're coming and telling them what the plans of the enemies are. But I think really the most obvious reading is they're just a bit scared. They're paranoid. The propaganda of the enemy forces has infected them, and they are presenting this picture of disaster that's impending to Nehemiah and the workers. Now, I'm saying that this is all to be expected. Hostility is the normal environment of the Christian life, and we're to not be alarmed by it. In this world, Jesus says, you will have trouble. Okay, the moment that we think that is somehow not the norm, or not something that Christ even expects for us, then we're in trouble. He says, yes, you'll have trouble in this world, but fear not, I've overcome the world. That's the antidote, isn't it? We'll come to more of that in a moment. Even if verse 12, where the Jews come and tell them this news, even if it was paranoia, it was still useful. Why was it useful? It was useful for the same reason that the stray musket was useful to James II. In 1685, the Duke of Monmouth, he led a rebellion against King James II. You may have heard of it, right? He landed at Lyme Regis. He wasn't the kind of, he thought he would be he should be king. And he landed at Lyme Regis to start a rebellion against King James II. He attempted to march on Bristol. He failed. He was driven back, and he had to flee back to a place called Bridgewater. The king's army pursued him, and he thought he would make one final last attempt to beat this army. And so in desperation, he planned the surprise attack for the night of July the 6th. So in the middle of the night, under cover of darkness, the Duke of Monmouth's army, or what was left of it, approached the royal army camp, and he gave orders that no one was to make any sound, and if somebody made a sound, they were to be immediately stabbed by their neighbour, to make sure that nobody let the cat out of the bag, gave the game away, that they were planning a secret attack. However, as some of the men crossed a river a mile or so from the royalist camp, a musket went off, and a royalist patrol was alerted, and that was that. Secret was out. And they had lost the element of surprise, and basically, to cut a long story short, Monmouth's army received a royal kicking at the what's now called the Battle of Sedgemoor. You may have heard of it. I think the last battle on like that, major battle on English soil. Anyway, what's my point? My point was, the element of surprise was key, and once they'd lost it, they lost the battle. The other side gained the advantage as soon as they were aware of the threat, and the other side had lost that element of surprise. This report to the of the Jews in verse 12 did the same thing as that musket. It let the cat out of the bag, as it were. The method of attack that Judah's enemies had planned was dependent upon the element of surprise. Maybe not so apparent immediately, but if we read it carefully in verse 11, it says, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them. We'll kill them, put an end to the work. They were planning on doing it secretly, on coming and surprising them, attacking them when they weren't expecting it. They'll be right there among them, they said. And then we will kill them and put an end to their work. So those reports that were received, whether they were the fruit of paranoia or not, all the same, it helped to subvert or remove that element of surprise, so that the Jews in Jerusalem building the walls were made ready, were made more expectant of an attack. And that was what led to their success in future. Because when hostility is your normal environment, readiness is your best protection. And that's the second thing we need to say. If you're ready, then you'll be best protected when hostility is your constant environment. One of the major features of our enemy strategy today, I think, is that same element of surprise. What do I mean by that? Well, really, that he wants us to expect normal Christianity to be straightforward. So that when he comes along, we treat his attacks as an interruption, right? Rather than as our normal environment. He wants us to see, I'm talking about the devil, in case that's not very clear. He wants us to think that his attacks, his temptations are interruptions, are that the normal course and flow of our life should generally be peaceful. And that when he comes in, that is something abnormal and strange and a surprise. He wants to create a peacetime mentality in us. He wants to create a peacetime mentality. Think that everything is basically fine and there will come skirmishes at points. That's the opposite of what the Bible presents to us as the normal Christian life. The last thing the devil wants is for us to be ready for a fight because we're expectant of attacks, of this constant hostility. He would rather we didn't expect him. He prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour, but he'd rather that we didn't know. He'd rather that we weren't expecting it because we're easier to trap when we're not ready. Surely you know that. Surely I know that, don't you? The times when you think you're safest, the times when we can be most prone to fall. If you are sure that you're standing firm, Paul says, you be careful that you don't fall. So Satan fears every stray musket waking up our patrols to his danger. He fears that. He cursed these paranoid Jews in Nehemiah's day. They gave the game away. Attack was imminent. And so Jerusalem was able to become aware of that, and Jerusalem got ready. Readiness is the best protection when hostility is your normal environment. So we need to get the muskets out, right? Let's look just for a moment at, firstly, the methods of readiness. Look at verse 13. They recognized their weak points. He stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places. So Nehemiah thought about it. He recognized where the weak points were. And he put defenders there particularly. Some parts of the wall were higher than others. Well, where it was more broken down, where the work hadn't yet continued quite so much, he said, right, stand there and you be ready. And point your guns, your bows and arrows, okay, over the wall. At that point, the application is simple to us, isn't it? Recognizing our weak points, knowing where we are most prone to fall, most prone to stumble, we need to particularly reinforce those points. Secondly, on the methods of readiness, sticking together. He posted them, verse 13, by families. And then in verse 14, when he speaks to them, he says, fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. There was something about them that he wanted them to get together. He wanted them to be united. He wanted them to work in families with those who knew each other, who were able to support each other. He didn't just say, well, you man, you stand there, and then 200 yards down the wall, you man stand there and separate yourself up. You know, he said, if you're family, great. You know each other, you stick together. And again, I hope the application is fairly straightforward, that God doesn't call us to live on our own, to be islands, to be lone rangers. Lone rangers are dead rangers, as one I was reading recently said, that we must work together. We must be willing to support each other and not be ashamed to ask for help and to look for support from other believers. So recognizing weak points, sticking together. Thirdly, being suitably armed. Verse 13, he said, take your swords and your spears and your bows. Okay, I'm not going to I am going to spiritualize that. Okay, there's armor in the New Testament, is there not? Which we have to take up. The sword of the Spirit, the breastplate of righteousness, the belt of truth. That's the armor we have now, because our warfare is not against flesh and blood, but against the spiritual forces in the heavenly places. I know of a man who every morning he gets up, he sits on his bed, and he consciously puts on the armor. He takes prays through the belt of truth and puts it on, as it were, and puts on the breastplate of righteousness, puts on the helmet of salvation. He spends 5 minutes at the beginning of his day putting the armor on, being ready for a day like that. I think that's a good thing. Okay, they were suitably armed. Fourth, cultivating courage. Verse 14, Nehemiah says, he exhorts them, he gets them going, says, don't be afraid of them. Well, how does he do that? Fifthly, he does it by remembering the Lord. They weren't just to get themselves together and come on, try your hardest, but he says, remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight. That's the only reason we can't be afraid, isn't it? The devil is a fearful prospect. The enemies are the people of God. And yet he says, don't be afraid. Why not remember the Lord? Again, we would do well to just stop and think and consider who God is and his power, his greatness, his awesomeness, his terribleness against his enemies, his willingness and lovingness towards us to help us in our fights. Remember the Lord and what he is like. That is the source of courage. And then fifthly, and the methods of readiness, resolving to fight. Resolving to fight. All of this is no good, is it? Unless you actually say, right, that's what we're going to do. We're going to fight. I am going to. We are going to. We're going to stick together. We're going to recognize our weak points. We're going to be suitably armed. We're going to cultivate courage. Remember the Lord. But we've got to fight. And so it's simple, of course, but it's vital. So those were the methods of readiness. These are the rewards of readiness now. In verse 15, when our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. Now, it's a really interesting statement there, because what doesn't happen is, right, they get ready to fight and then the enemy comes on and they do their best and they get their swords out and they fight and there's a great victory and that's how God frustrates their plot. That's not what happens, is it? It says, when our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. When it says God frustrated their plot, it is equating that with the enemies realizing that the people of God were ready, not the enemies coming up close with hand-to-hand warfare. It was simply realizing that these guys had a resolution to fight, that they were ready for an attack. That was the be-all and end-all. That was the frustration of the plot. That was the end of it. It came to nothing because the enemies of the people of God realized that the people of God weren't just going to lie down and be trampled on. And so without a blow given, without a sword drawn, the plot's frustrated simply because they have become resolved to fight, simply because readiness has become their way of thinking. Readiness, I'm saying, is our best protection when hostility is our normal environment. Readiness alone had stripped the enemy of their advantage and had dissuaded them from attack. Saying, I'm not going to be a pushover, is a first step to not being a pushover. Don't let the enemy have the advantage of the element of surprise. That's the key. Always rob him of it by insistence in your personal life, insistence on readiness for a hostile environment. That's our best protection. Okay, so that's the reward of readiness. The plot is frustrated. They can get back to their work. But then, thirdly, we see the persistence of readiness. The persistence of readiness. It's important to realize that this action that they've taken, it meant that the opposition backed down at this point, as we've been saying, and it didn't come again for the moment. And Nehemiah and co. could return to work, as we've seen in verse 15. So after verse 15, there is a lull in opposition. That's important to realize. There's not these threats. There's not this fist waving by Sanballat and his friends. But even though there is this lull, Nehemiah and the people in Jerusalem saw no reason to give up the posture of readiness. That's very important. We see it persisting beyond the time when they have this immediate threat. It persists on to the time where it seems to have gone away for the moment. And that's what we see in verses 16 and following, that they carry on in this assumption that hostility will always be there lurking at all times. They maintain their readiness. In verse 16, first, they stay equipped with their weaponry. So if you had, you were equipped with spears and shields and bows and armor, it says there in verse 16, and half the men did the work, half the men were equipped with that armor. If you had a spare hand and you were working, something went in it, a weapon, a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. Sorry, sword and trowel, fine. And if you didn't have a hand free at all, you had a sword in the sheath, ready to pull out if you needed it. That's what it says in verse 18, okay? So, in other words, there was no place for laying down the armor. If you had a spare hand, you used it. And if even if you didn't, you had it there ready, waiting. And some of the men were particularly assigned to just do that. Half the people were still ready for war. And similarly today, there's no place for laying down the armor of God. It should always be there, ready to be used. So that's the first thing. They stayed equipped with weaponry. Secondly, they had an early warning system put in place. In verse 18, the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with Nehemiah. Well, that's a bit of a funny thing perhaps to say until you read on and you realize that Nehemiah is establishing an early warning system so that because the people are spread out along the wall, they need to be able to gather quickly when there is a threat of an attack. And so he says, verse 20, whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. So it's a method of gathering the people so that if an attack comes, they will quickly and efficiently be able to come and fight it. We need those too, don't we? We need our early warning systems. We need to watch for the earliest signs of trouble and have our own trumpets that go off in our consciences and our lives. And we're able to put those things to death straight away. When I used to have fights with my brothers, fairly often, when, you know, not too, you know, quite a long time ago now, but it was always the refrain of my father to say, stop it before it starts. Well, we had started already, but stop it before it starts. Okay, that was always that's how wars start, he'd say. What are you talking about? That's how wars start. There you go. Stop it before it starts. It's a good principle, isn't it? As soon as it starts, you stop it. And that's absolutely right. There's a pastor I know in Bristol. It's very interesting. I was talking to him. He was talking to me really about his marriage. I'm not quite sure why, but he said, whenever I say something uncalled for to my wife, I aim to apologize within the next 5 seconds. Okay. So he said, if I let it go, it will just fester the whole day, you know, or it'll be hard. The longer it goes on, the harder it gets. So I need to get it quickly. She tries to do the same thing. Whenever I say something, I think, shouldn't have said that. Ruth, I'm sorry. Straight away. It's early warning system in his life. I was impressed. I remember another pastor that many of us would know talking about sexual temptation, talking about lustful thoughts. And he said, you have a 3-second window when you have a lustful thought. 3-second window. If you don't cut it out then it will go on, it will grow, and it will be a problem, and it will turn into something worse. Later on, you have a 3-second window to cut it out. Early warning system. It's important. It's for men and women. Some of you, I'm sure you know about the 10-second rule when food falls on the floor. No? You know? Okay. We did. 10-second rule. Oh, it's all right, you know. The bugs don't have enough time to get to it within that time, you know. But if you have a 10-second rule for that, maybe you don't. But why not for our thought lives? Why not a rule which says, it's only, you know, I'm not going to allow more than 10 seconds to sit there and allow the bugs of jealousy and of pride and of envy and of unbelief to gather and give me a cruel and horrible disease of self-centeredness. An early warning system. But finally, at the crux of it is remembering that the Lord is still the one who will finally give the victory. You put all these things in place, but unless you say, our God will fight for us, verse 20, it will collapse, won't it? That's the point. He says, you need to gather here, not so that, wow, we can have a go, you know, we can do our best, but because our God will fight for us. So if we do these things without dependence upon God, then it will be futile. Without me, you can do nothing, Jesus said. So that's a simple thing that you all know, and I still want you to remember it and be reminded of it. Now, this last paragraph here, from verse 21 on, is very interesting, because we started out this evening with hostility being the normal environment of the people of God there and now. Our normal environment, hostility. And we've seen that the response to that as a Christian is to realize that readiness is our best protection. Well, that's what they did. And in doing so then, what has happened? Interestingly enough, now readiness has become their normal environment. Okay, so they started off hostility, normal environment. Readiness, the best protection. And now in this last paragraph, we see that readiness has become their normal environment, their way of life. You see that from the first light of dawn, verse 21, until the stars came out. So all day there, and then in verse 22, all night. Have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night, so they can serve as guards by night and workmen by day. So all day and all night, they're ready. And then even when they sleep, they are sleeping in their clothes, so they can jump up at the first moment and be ready. That's what it says in verse 23. Neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor the guards with me took off our clothes. But they're sleeping in their clothes so they can be ready to fight when they need to. Each had his weapon. Even going for water was subordinate to this. There's a slight kind of, what does that word, that what does that phrase really mean? And different versions have different things. It could be even a weapon in his right hand when he went for water. It's not really the point. The point is, in all situations, at every point, weapons were close by, ready to use. They were ready to jump up and fight. Readiness had become their way of life, had become their normal environment. And it should be ours too. Well, I trust God will help us to do that then as we think on those things.